Welcome to Cairo Nights. News boss Frank Shires is here, as is Chairman of the Board Shane Peterson. I am Mike Lewis. We've got a busy show tonight. A lot of breaking news. This is probably going to be the biggest item in terms of conversation that is going to be happening for the next, year. Washington's High Court struck down the law that makes unintentional possession of drugs a crime. Now, if it sounds like unintentional possession is something that's easily proven, this is going to be the sort of the pivot point in this new law. This law is actually... So what the Supreme Court did was essentially say, it's based on a case out of Spokane. This case said that there was a woman who was caught. She had a small packet of meth in her pocket. She said, and her boyfriend testified, that she was not a regular or was not a drug user. She said she had grabbed the pants from a friend. They fit, wore them out, got busted. I'm not sure what she got busted for. I don't remember seeing that in the court documents. But they found that on her, and she said that she was, you know, and she got convicted of possession of meth. So this went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court essentially said this. Now, the practical application of this is going to be something else, but the specific application is that she did not have, there was no intent for her to be carrying those drugs or something along those lines, that it was something that was already in the pants prior to her putting those on. You may find that implausible. I'm not going to go down that road. I'm not interested as much in that as the practical application of the law. And that means this. That essentially gives law enforcement a higher standard by which to have to prove that someone intended on carrying those drugs. So if you get caught with a small amount of drugs and you say, I don't even know whose those are, I did not know that they were in my car, something along those lines, it's going to be very, very difficult for law enforcement to bust you. And in fact, well, so this was put out by the Sheriff's Association in Washington State. And they put out their own guidance for officers arresting people in this particular case. And it's far-reaching, and this is going to be something that I suspect that the legislature is going to have to deal with, because effectively this has decriminalized. Now, the legislature was already thinking about doing this in forms of legislation, and that could just obviate this decision entirely. But at this particular juncture, it effectively legalizes personal use amounts of drugs, because it's very, very difficult to prove. The intent standard is going to be very difficult to prove in court. And so, reflecting that, and I think cops agree with that point. Well, they don't necessarily agree with the ruling, but they agree with that point that proving intent is going to be difficult. Here's what they refer to. This is guidance for Washington law enforcement officers. No longer authorized to conduct a criminal investigation, effect an arrest, seek a search warrant, or take any other enforcement action for simple possession of controlled substance pursuant to RCW 69.250.4013. So, we believe that prosecutors will soon take the following action. And this is important to listen to. Arrange for the immediate release of all pretrial detainees whose only charged offenses are simple possession. So this means that people who are currently in jail for simple possession charges, if that's the only charge that they are facing, they are likely... This is, again, this is not the attorneys, the prosecutors saying this, but this is law enforcement saying that they expect that this is going to happen, that they are going to start vacating judgments of all persons in the jails who are currently only serving time on simple possession. This is best done by sending listed defendants to their attorneys. So what they're actually saying is proactively, you might want to go ahead and go into your jails and start releasing the simple possession person, because it's going to start happening. Anyway, recall all the arrest warrants issued. This is number C, or letter C. Recall all of the arrest warrants issued in cases in which the only charge is simple possession of drugs. Either dismiss with prejudice all cases in which only the charge is simple possession of drugs of note of drugs, or note up a motion to file an amended information that charges another crime. So all of this is to say, and the list goes on and on. And this is the point. The list comes from, let's go back to that. Just lost that page. So this is the problem that we're running into here, or the issue that we're running into here, is that the Supreme Court stepped out in front of where existing law is. In fact, it eliminated that. So this means that simple possession in Washington State at this particular juncture is unlikely to get you arrested and unlikely to keep you in jail if, and I don't know how many people in jail are necessarily our Cairo listeners, but I would say that this is a type of, if you have somebody in jail that you know that is a relative of yours that is facing just a simple possession charge, this may be the thing that gets them out. If you are really unhappy about this, it might be a good idea to contact your legislature and find out whether or not that is exactly what the legislature is intending on doing. Now, the legalization bill that is pushed somewhat through, actually, it's just been written. I don't think it's pushed through very far at all. That is something that would accomplish some of the same goals in a slightly different way. And I'm not sure that these two ideas can necessarily be married. And now remember, sometimes what happens with simple possession is that it was simple possession and someone had a small amount of drugs they were going to do themselves and they got sent into jail. Sometimes that simple possession is used as an enhancer for other things. Sometimes that simple possession is what gets you rolled up from parole or probation. So these are the type of things, there are ancillary things that come from simple possession that were not really considered in the Supreme Court decision. And so that's going to be a little bit of a mess for the state to deal with. But trust me on this one, you are going to be hearing, this is an unusual decision. You're going to be hearing about it all day tomorrow and hopefully we'll get a legal expert on to talk a bit about what this actually is going to mean from a practical application and what it means in conjunction with that legislation to legalize personal use amounts of drugs, as Oregon did and Washington is considering doing. And we'll try and have more for you on that tomorrow. Now, back to, of course, the consistent issue at hand. This is more coronavirus. Another mutated version of the coronavirus popped up in New York City. Experts reacted to the news with a mixture of caution and concern. This is from CBS news correspondent Meg Oliver. She reports that help could be on the way.
Tonight, the FDA approved Pfizer's request to store its vaccine in pharmacy freezers for 2 weeks instead of ultra-cold specialized units. This as Pfizer and Moderna are testing whether a booster shot of their vaccines can protect against the variant identified in South Africa.
What we care about is making sure people don't get sick, they don't get hospitalized, and of course, most importantly, that they don't die.
Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
And come from the White House, the CBS News correspondent Natalie Brand has the latest on the Biden administration's efforts to fight the pandemic.
President Biden and Vice President Harris are marking more than 50 million COVID vaccine shots delivered, more than halfway to the goal of 100 million shots in their first 100 days.
This administration will follow the science to deliver more breakthroughs.
First day that I got the shot, I felt fine. The next day, I realized I needed to take it a little slow. And then the day after, it was like nothing ever happened, but I knew I was vaccinated.
Earlier, the vice president spoke about her experience with the vaccine at a grocery store pharmacy as she and health experts are stepping up efforts to speak to those who may be hesitant about receiving the shot.
So that is, we're going to get, and trust me, that we are going to get more stories about more variants. This is not going to stop at this particular juncture. It looks like, largely speaking, all of the vaccines are at least somewhat, if not very effective against any of the new variants. Some of them are more contagious than others. We will likely see more mutations. As we get better at fighting it, we're going to see more mutations. But it doesn't look like anything is stepping outside what the parameters are for what the vaccine is able to deal with at this point. It's just a matter of getting that vaccine, right? None of the eight regions of Washington. So as we're going to see this, and we're probably going to see an uptick in infections, none of the eight regions of Washington's COVID-19 reopening plan are going backward toward more restrictions anytime soon. This is according to Governor Jay Inslee in an announcement today.
During this week's long pause, we will evaluate the situation and work with our public health partners and stakeholders on how to continue going forward. So why are we doing this? Well, during the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, our rolling average for new daily COVID cases was approaching 3,000 per day. That has come down dramatically. Now they're in the range below 1,000 per day. So this has been a very significant reduction in cases in our state. And I want to credit Washingtonians for what everybody's been doing. And wearing masks and being safe is the reason we're knocking these numbers down.
And so what we're going to see now in Washington state, well, we are currently at phase two, which is, what's a good way to describe phase two? Phase two is sort of is a 25%. You can be at 25% occupancy if you are a business, a bar or restaurant or gymnasium. The spacing issues still have to be adhered to. But outside the groups have to be six people or under at the table. This is essentially a capacity. If you are a place that doesn't have outside seating, a capacity to limp along. If you are a place that does have outside seating, it still affects you on the number of people you can put at a table, obviously, and all of those sort of things. I mean, not a lot of places, given that it's also winter. It is not going to be easy for any place to move along in phase two, but it certainly is better than phase one. What the governor didn't say today was anything to do with phase three. The plan's second phase, that's what we're in right now. And you can serve alcohol until 11 p.m. The indoor fitness centers specifically and entertainment venues can also operate at 25% capacity. Establishments that only serve alcohol and no food, however, must remain closed. And so this has not actually helped any of the music venues, for example. I mean, conceivably, the ones that serve food could still open. But music club economics, I guess, is a good way to put it, don't really work when you have 30 people in the room. The bands aren't making any money at that. The bars aren't making any money at that. And so those are less likely to reopen at this particular point. There's a really good interview a few weeks ago with the owners of the Tractor Tavern in Ballard. And they said, you know, it just doesn't really pencil out when your place is kind of built around 400 people being in there and you can have 30 or 40. It just doesn't quite work. And if you're thinking that the math says, hey, wait a minute, the math says 25%. It doesn't say 10% is what is the numbers I'm just giving you. Here's the thing, and this is a really important point, and you can ask anybody in the restaurant or nightclub business validation for this. The occupancy rate thing is not really the number to focus on. It's the distance, because many places, and I think that most nightclubs would fall into this, most music venues would fall into this notion. The distancing is the more important determinator, because you can't get, for example, you can't get to 25. If you have a 400 person venue, like say the Tractor Tavern, and you try to put 100 people in there, you will be nowhere near the distancing requirements. And so you don't really worry as much about the distancing requirements as you were rather about the occupancy requirements, because you can't even really realistically get to them. And when they go to 50%, you're still not going to be able to get to them. The occupancy standard, it does apply to some degree for the large restaurants where people are still, they're at distinct, separate, small locations than from other people. It makes some sense for them. I know that some of them also can't really get to those numbers. But it was designed around kind of an idea that doesn't quite work with the other standards. And the other standards being, of course, the really important ones, which are the spacing and that is the one, how big the groups are and how long you linger in those groups and things like that. And so those are the things actually that most restaurant and nightclub people are going to be concerned about. But the governor also had some encouraging news today. And he stressed the fact that we're still going to care and follow the science.
Now, we know we need to follow the science and the data in making these decisions, but I think it is clear that we have had enough success in the recent weeks to be able to put a pause on any alternative that regions would go backwards. So that's what we are doing today. I'm happy to do that.
And a couple more news items. One larger but overseas and one local. I'll do the overseas one first. The United States launched an airstrike today on Syria. This is from CBS News' Ed O'Keefe.
Tonight, U.S. officials confirm airstrikes on multiple sites in Syria linked to Iranian-backed militias. The Pentagon says the strike was carried out in response to recent rocket attacks on locations in Iraq, where U.S. troops and personnel are located. It was the first military action ordered by President Biden. The Pentagon says he ordered the strike earlier Thursday and described it as a proportionate military response. The Defense Department said the operation sends an unambiguous message that the president will act to protect American coalition personnel. Ed O'Keefe, CBS News, Washington.
According to the New York Times, the rocket attack on it was a rocket attack on February 15th on the airport at Erbil in northern Iraq that killed a Filipino contractor with the American military-led military coalition and wounded six others, including a Louisiana National Guard soldier and four American contractors. And that is what they are retaliating for. And this is largely an Iranian-backed group, apparently, that the United States attacked. And then the last small item, bring that very home domestically, at least as far as their headquarters go, Costco has decided to, given its apparent extraordinary profits during the pandemic and the fact that it feels like its workers deserve a little bit more, has raised its minimum wage. Now, Costco frequently pays people better than minimum, but its own internal minimum wage has been raised to from $15 to $16 an hour. So that's good news for Costco. It's always been one of those places that I think has worked harder than some other big box stores to really do well by its employees. And that is Costco essentially saying that we believe that this frontline worker issue is one. The interesting thing is I don't know that it qualifies. I know QFC was right in the crosshairs, but I don't remember if the additional $4 an hour, in which would put everyone at $20 an hour, applies to Costco in the same manner that it applies to the literal grocery stores in the Seattle ordinance. And I'll have to take a look on that. I don't think it does, but I'm going to double check that. So that would actually put those folks at $20 an hour working in Costco. Not terrible, but still tough in an expensive place like this. All right, coming up, we've got Rachel Bell. Big milestone on her excellent podcast, Your Last Meal. It's hitting its 100th episode, and you'll be really surprised how she decided to commemorate 100 episodes. It is right after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Kind of an auspicious day today for Rachel Bell. She is celebrating the 100th episode of her podcast, Your Last Meal.
Yes. And so usually on Your Last Meal, I interview celebrities. But this time in honor of the 100th, I thought it would be fun to interview 100-year-old people. And by people, I mean women, because the women always outlast the men. So I interviewed three 100-year-old women who live in the Seattle region. And I'm just going to focus on one for this story here. But you can tune into the podcast to hear all of the stories. But I'm going to introduce you to a woman named Eleanor Owen. 100 years old, Seattle's Eleanor Owen lives on her own in her big old house. She drives, she's not on a single medication, and she's sharp with an enviable memory. Her 100th birthday was in January.
I have 300 birthday cards, if not more, that I haven't opened yet. They sent me 100 roses from which my son and I are now making wine.
Wait, 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 wait. You can make wine out of roses?
Yeah. Yes, my son and my husband had done it when he was a kid. And so now, if you were here, you would find an aroma in the house of something fermenting.
The rose wine will ferment all year. And Eleanor hopes to have a lot of guests over to drink it when she turns 101.
I suffer from an addiction called TSA, thrift store addiction.
Oh.
I have 312 wine glasses. Nice people would say that I collect.
Eleanor has one of the most varied and fascinating careers of anyone I've ever encountered. And she has the Wikipedia page to prove it. She grew up the daughter of Italian immigrants in New York's Hudson Valley. Eleanor was extremely bright and graduated 2 years early.
My first paying job was as a cover reporter on the Newburgh Daily News for $17 a week. And I saved every penny and actually went to New York City and enrolled at Trapagan School of Design. I actually was fairly successful as a designer and costumer for modern dancers, primarily Merce Cunningham. I did all of his shows.
Eleanor was also an actor, and she was cast in 2 Broadway productions, a few off-Broadway shows, and she directed children's theater in New York. When her husband took a job that moved them to rural Washington and then to Seattle, she continued to teach drama. Eleanor and her husband had 2 children, and when he was a teenager, their son Jody started showing severe symptoms of schizophrenia. After she found a noose he had hung in the basement, she tried desperately to get him help. But he wouldn't take medication, and she could not get him hospitalized.
And a terrible tragedy took place. He took one of my husband's guns, went to a tavern, shot up in the ceiling of the tavern. Men jumped on him, but the gun went off and killed somebody. A tragedy that can't be undone. And my son was declared innocent by reason of insanity. My first visit to Western State Hospital, he just wasn't there. He could not return to reality.
Her son remained in the psychiatric hospital for many years, and Eleanor could not concentrate on anything else. So she quit her job as a professor at the University of Washington. She connected with other parents who were also unable to help their mentally ill children. And she started going to Olympia and meeting with legislators.
And my definition of grave disability was turned into law. Now, I did not know at the time that this was a difficult thing to introduce, get passed in both houses, and signed by the governor in 1 year.
The same year, 1979, Eleanor and those other parents formed the Washington Advocates of the Mentally Ill, which soon became NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is still the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization, providing support, education, and advocacy in 1,200 U.S. locations. Eleanor went from Broadway to mental health advocacy, and she continued to fight in Olympia, where she became known as the Barracuda. Eleanor's son, Jody, is now in his early 60s and doing very well. He lives on his own. He works. His medication is under control. He's thriving thanks to Eleanor's dedication. You can hear a whole lot more from Eleanor, including her last meal, by tuning in to the 100th episode of Your Last Meal. But here is her parting thought on how to age gracefully.
Oh, you have to keep your teeth. If you don't have good teeth, you're not going to be able to stay well.
So that's just a portion of my Eleanor interview. If you want to hear more with her, because she is, as you could hear, very fascinating, and you want to hear about her last meal, there are also 2 other women that I interviewed, and, you know, a 1-year anniversary, you're supposed to give the gift of paper, and a 50th anniversary, you're supposed to give the gift of gold. But little known fact, for your 100th, you're supposed to give meatballs. Not many people know that. So I interviewed the head of culinary at IKEA America to ask her, why did a furniture store full of umlauts become synonymous with Swedish meatballs? So that's on there as well. And also, a lot of people are eating alone during the pandemic. You know, if you're single and you live alone, chances are you've been eating alone a lot. So I had the host of a podcast called Dinner for One. It's this really great woman. She is an American expat who's living in France and Paris. And her podcast is about post-divorce, how she taught herself to cook and to enjoy eating by herself post-divorce to kind of find herself again.
Wow. Yeah, that was a this is a dynamite podcast. Thank you a bunch. I actually have a question sort of broadly about does it feel it probably does. Does it feel like 100 podcasts? I mean, that's an extraordinary number to get to, given everyone, you know, is starting a podcast, but rarely do people actually make such a good one. And rarer still, does it last 100 episodes?
Thanks. Yeah, it does feel like 100 episodes because it's been 4.5 years.
Yeah.
A lot of people do, you know, a weekly podcast. So this one has been mostly bi-weekly. Sometimes we take 3 weeks to make it. So I feel like, you know, a lot of people have pumped out more than 100 by now. But when I think about it as 100 different celebrities that I've spoken to or met, then it kind of sounds like a lot to me. But yeah, I'm really, really proud of it. I am. This is my baby. Unlike a lot of podcasts where it's just discussion, there's a lot of production that goes into it. So we work hard. That's kind of the back stuff. And if you want to listen to this episode, you can text 100, just the numbers, 100 to 98973, and we'll text it to you. It's on all the podcast platforms. You could listen at yourlastmealpodcast.com. And that's where you can find all of the episodes. But yeah, like I said, this one is featuring three 100-year-old women, which was a good lesson for me because if you've been listening to me for a while, you can hear I speak quickly. And if you've been in a room with me, you know, I walk very fast and
right.
I think really fast and I'm just a fast person. And when you're hanging out with 100-year-old people, they are not. And so I had to have a lot of patience to let them talk and kind of think in the middle of a sentence instead of interrupting them and trying to push, you know, to the next subject. So that was a good lesson for me.
All right, Rachel. Well, folks, make sure you download that one. It's dynamite. And Rachel, thanks. We will talk to you on, you're off Friday. We'll talk to you on Monday.
See you on Monday.
Stay tuned for Cairo Nights right after the break.
Rachel Bell.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. You folks may have noticed, actually you probably didn't. If you're living in Tacoma, you might remember a year ago when the Tacoma City Council decided to eliminate the need. Well, maybe 2018, maybe 2 years ago. Eliminate the need for bike helmets. The feeling was that the helmet laws were disproportionately applied to people of color. And in their small sample size, only about 20 arrests, but in their small sample size, they found that to be the case, that more black people were arrested than proportional to the population than white people. Although more white people overall were arrested, the whole thing was about 20 cases and a little difficult. As the Tacoma News Tribune editorial board pointed out, a little difficult to get a real sample size on that. But that is actually now making its way to King County, and they are taking a look with much more data. They're taking a look at whether or not this would be true, and here's the idea behind it, that while helmets are considered, there's a little bit of argument about this, but generally speaking, helmets are considered, especially if you get the type of injury that's a head injury on a bicycle, way safer, much more, you're much more likely to survive, much more likely for it not to be a serious injury, certainly to your head, if you have a helmet on, which stands goes to reason. And so a lot of cities have passed helmet laws to enact this, but they're finding that something along the lines of like, you know, some of the data involving who gets pulled over for having a taillight out and things like that, that these laws may have been disproportionately applied to people of color. And so the question then becomes, well, one, why? And then two, is it strictly because it's some form of racial profiling? And it appears that the data isn't as clear on that. It's there have been people who have argued that when you're pulling over a person of color, especially in certain areas of town, and you're dealing with people who are potentially of lower income, and of course that isn't true universally, you're going to have many more people who can't afford a bike helmet. Bike helmets range in price from $35 to $300 or $400, depending on what you want to buy. But generally speaking, you can find a one that will provide reasonably good safety in the $60 range. That's been my experience. I've been a lifetime bicycle commuter. But that still is. That's a lot of money, especially if you're a young person and you're on a bicycle. That's no small amount of change.
And so are you going to find that people of lower income are buying bicamels? Yes, absolutely. And are you going to find that maybe they haven't been as indoctrinated? I mean, if they have parents who are avid cyclists and are always wearing all the gear, you get indoctrinated in needing all the gear. The motorcyclists refer to it as all the gear all the time. Are you going to be more indoctrinated in that culture? Yeah, I think absolutely you are. So I get that there's going to be cultural, financial divides, as well as, is it potential that police are more likely to notice someone of color out on a bicycle? I don't know about that. I don't know the data on that, but the data at least is convincing that certainly those people are getting more tickets. So you can draw your own conclusions with that. But should we actually be throwing out the baby with the bathwater or the bike helmet with the bathwater in this particular case? And maybe that is not the idea. If you think about what we spend on enforcing these bike laws with, you know, cops writing tickets and pulling people over at X hourly rate and processing these tickets through the court system, it seems to me like maybe the better alternative is for a city to find some way, and maybe means tested in some fashion, but find some way just to provide bike helmets to people. I mean, if you want them, if you feel statistically that they matter and that you should wear them and that you can put helmets of a variety of sizes inside, you know, a city worker's vehicle or inside, you know, who are out in the city doing other things or inside a police cruiser's trunk, something along those lines. And I know that they have other things to do and they have other things to put in those cases. I get you. But still, if you could find some way to distribute free helmets and maybe use that as your solution without actually criminalizing it, maybe that's what we need to do. Or maybe, you know, slightly misdemeanor, criminalize it. I mean, they were never very much by way of tickets anyway. They were usually relatively inexpensive. But maybe that is the better first blush. And if you manage to lose two helmets, well, fine, you're getting a fine on the third one. But maybe some sort of program that actually solves the problem by solving the problem rather than solves the problem by enforcing an issue. And it seems like we could probably spend a little less money. We could actually achieve the goal. And the goal is keeping people's heads safe. I mean, this is not super complicated. I mean, I am on a bicycle. I never go out for a ride without a helmet on. Never. And on a motorcycle, well, of course, you can't legally on a motorcycle. You can't really on a bicycle either. But that the likelihood of I've never been when I have made it like a quick run to the store without a helmet on with my bicycle, which is pretty rare. Of course, I've never been stopped. Now, I don't know if I was never seen to be stopped. I don't know. But the point is that maybe this is one of those cases where we should just find some way, especially if a city could work a deal, a purchase in bulk, work with a nonprofit, and there are nonprofits that do this regarding bike helmets. And maybe that's just the way we should look at it. Rather than figuring out criminalizing or decriminalizing, I mean, why don't we figure out a way just to get people helmets? And maybe that's what we should focus on in these sort of situations. All right, coming up, we've got a dynamite story from Cairo's own Diane Duthweiler. She found she just has one of these perfect little full circle stories. A kid got influenced very young and managed 40 years later to sort of pay it back to his influencer. It's a dynamite story. You're not going to want to miss it. Coming up right after the break.